Hello and welcome to the IAA Mobility Visionary Club, where we are introducing you to the pioneers on the cutting edge of transportation. My name is Sarah Harmon. Each month, we'll be talking to CEOs, industry titans, and disruptors about the future of mobility and what's driving them. I cannot wait to dive into this next chat. Our speaker this week is the founder and CEO of hashtag Cities First Advisors, Scott Shepard. Scott has got a great podcast on the intersection of AI, urbanism, shared mobility, active mobility, and decarbonization. I highly encourage you to give that a listen. Scott Shepard, welcome to the IAA Mobility Visionary Club. It's such a treat to have you with us today.
Thank you, Sarah. It's a pleasure. So 2019 was probably one of the final years of, let's say, the status quo of urbanism. While there has been much, let's say, anticipation and moves and, let's say, mandates for trying to kind of take back control of our cities based upon a lot of the poor urban planning decisions that were made during the 20th century, especially after World War II, the Second World War, where it put primacy towards, you know, single car usage, single family home zoning, as well as really unsustainable urban, you know, development models in the US and even here in Europe. What we saw is the COVID pandemic was a real turning point in terms of how we view public spaces and how we view the built environment. And, you know, it's kind of, let's say, you know, silver lining to a dark cloud. Although, you know, we look at this as a real dark event, you know, in human history and just our recent times, even though it was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. In reality, this served from an urbanist perspective as a pause or reflection point to actually reconfigure our public spaces. And what I mean by that is here in Europe and to some extent in the United States, Canada, and other markets too, we saw a lot of experimentation and intervention in new, let's say, urban planning projects and new urban design schemes that were already on the drawing board or in plans, you know, kind of gathering dust on shelves, you know, from the 1940s all the way through the 2010s and 2020s. But this allowed for this kind of, let's say, activation of new types of modalities, such as cycling, such as walking, scooting, et cetera, in the public spaces. And what I mean by that is basically, you know, we saw just a plethora of new cycle lanes that were introduced here throughout Europe, pop-up bike lanes in Berlin, Corona ways. We saw car-free city centers. We saw, you know, shared public spaces. And a lot of these concepts were developed again over many, many decades. I mean, a perfect example, not to kind of get too deep into this or geek out too much, but in the Netherlands, because Netherlands,
yeah, you're in the right place.
Yeah. So so if we want to talk about, you know, holding up models of cycling and sustainable mobility, we always look towards the Netherlands. We look at Denmark, those two countries, basically. But an interesting concept that was born in the Netherlands, a Dutch term, is called the Woonerf, W-O-O-N-E-R-F, and it's a living street. This living street was basically something that was repackaged and repurposed by urban planners in New York City, San Diego, Oakland, Austin, et cetera, and they call it an open street. This open street, which was adopted in the US around 2020, 2021, is a Woonerf. It's a living street, meaning that it allows for children to play, it slows down traffic, it calms the streets, and it allows for a range of activities. So any one of us who has really kind of studied urban planning or urban design will know the works of Jane Jacobs, who wrote The Death and Life of American Cities back in the 1960s. And she focuses on the street life of Greenwich Village in Lower Manhattan back, you know, 60 years ago, and how basically to activate streets, you know, walk up, you know, stoops, as well as kind of neighborhood zones, it's really important to have a range of activities 24/7 and not single uses. So it's not like everyone commuting with their car to the suburbs outside of LA or Atlanta or Denver, but actually having a range of activities to make communities vibrant. So it's all about really adding quality and purpose to our, you know, our built environment, our spaces. So a lot of these concepts that were, let's say, conceived or drawn up as maybe a counterpoint to the poor urban planning, this singular vision towards top-down urban development over the last almost 100 years starting to bear fruit during the pandemic. So this gets back to the concept of the post-COVID city, what we're talking about, because in the post-COVID city, it's about experimentation, flexibility, looking at tactical urbanism. It's really bottom-up. It's empowering communities so that they can start actually looking at providing a environment that is more sustainable and added value and quality. So just to kind of close out this one first topic or thought, it really, this event, this global event, which was terrible and horrific, the silver lining was that we were able to actually start moving away from that mid-20th century post-World War II urban planning paradigm that valued the automobile and single-family zoning towards a mix of uses and reactivating our public spaces. And now a lot of these projects are starting to accelerate, at least here in mainland Europe, a bit less in the US and North America right now. We see some projects that are being canceled are going back to reconfiguring public space back to the automobile, which is unfortunate. But here in Europe, there's dozens of projects throughout the continent, from Portugal to Latvia to Greece to Denmark, that are all utilizing this concept that you talked about, Sarah, of the SUMP, the Sustainable Urban Mobility Plan. And what the SUMP is, for anyone who's here in Europe, is it's the public policy document. So it's basically the long-range transportation plan using urbanization to reconfigure and build our public spaces with a strong emphasis in mobility. This is something that is kind of similar to the comprehensive urban planning process back in the United States, but it's much more, let's say, interdisciplinary, and it focuses on mobility as the common thread of how we basically build out and transform our cities for the next 20, 30, 40 year horizon. So just to kind of close this thought, the SUMP, the Sustainable Urban Mobility Plan, there's over 256 SUMPs throughout the European continent of 27 member states. So basically every city and metropolitan region in Europe has a SUMP. And the SUMPs all call for this sustainable urban change, this decarbonization of transport, and this modal shift towards active and shared modes, of which really fell in line with a lot of these transformations that happened during and post-COVID pandemic.
So what I'm hearing you say is that we're in kind of a new era now, post-pandemic. Yes. There's a lot of opportunity, a silver lining to what you rightly called a very dark cloud. I'm curious, Scott, to hear how you think the growing demand for sustainable and autonomous transportation is going to change the design of cities. In what ways will autonomous vehicles and shared mobility solutions improve transit access? And I'm thinking here especially about underserved communities, those places where it's not really easy to hop on a metro or a bus or a shared e-bike.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of sustainable and autonomous vehicles, let's kind of unpack this for a second. So there's certainly opportunities for autonomous vehicles and on-demand transport. So I'll just kind of hit on a few here and just within our time frame. But autonomous vehicles have some interesting promise in a shared capacity. And from my own personal perspective, there's a lot of opportunity in terms of integration with public transit systems and shared autonomous shuttles that can be served as a complement, not a replacement, but a complement to, let's say, traditional, well-performing, what we call in the industry, fixed route public transit, or here in Europe, public transport. We Americans call it transit, here in Europe, transport, same thing. So this autonomy layer, which, you know, really kind of started gathering steam, of course, with, you know, Waymo and Cruise and all these other providers in the Bay Area, San Francisco, you know, testing robo-taxis, autonomous vehicles and all that stuff, which is very interesting and experimental. In my opinion, you know, that has to go through a series of, let's say, maturity. But the real, I would say, interesting use case or promise is around shared autonomy, not singular autonomy. Shared autonomy holds promise for boosting usage of, again, I'll use the European term, public transport in underserved communities, like you said, Sarah. So what we call in the US, we Americans call transit deserts. These areas that are low density, they're suburban, they're not really well served by linear fixed route lines that serve kind of a higher number of passengers. So larger, let's say, coverage areas that are low density that could be captured or covered by autonomous shuttles that are shared, perhaps on demand. So this is a mixture of DRT, demand response transit, we call it here in Europe. Again, same term, but in the US, we call it microtransit. So we have two terms for the same thing on different sides of the Atlantic. So I'm just going to use the European term for today. So if we mix DRT with autonomous shared shuttles, that could be an interesting promise. It hasn't totally been proven yet in terms of kind of the commercial business models. That needs to kind of go through a little more maturity. But in terms of the use case of resolving equity and access for underserved areas that are left stranded or too auto-centric, interesting experience, experiments going on right now in Bavaria, in Munich, with MVG, the public transport agency in Munich, with shared autonomous shuttles. So we'll see how that goes, just to get back to, you know, what's happening in the German market. But I'm really kind of bullish on shared autonomy with mixing DRT in these underserved areas as a feeder to, you know, well-served fixed route. But we cannot utilize or think of autonomy or DRT / microtransit as a replacement for fixed route. It cannot cannibalize existing service. And unfortunately, that's a disturbing trend we're seeing in the United States right now. We're seeing several different DRT / microtransit interventions that are starting to replace or cannibalize fixed route. We don't want that, though, because then that is basically shifting operational budgets away from an existing service where you can basically offer much higher ridership to fewer riders served, but at the same budget. Because remember, when you have DRT and on-demand, you basically run a higher operational cost. So it basically costs more US dollars or euros to serve fewer passengers. So it's a policy trade-off, and all these need to be deliberated, you know, by politicians and mobility experts.
You mentioned trade-offs, which brings me to my next question.
Yeah.
Why is it important to approach mobility development as a holistic transformation rather than isolated initiatives? What benefits does an integrated approach bring, particularly from a mobility and sustainability perspective?
Because we should move away from silver bullets. There is no one size fits all. And we should also move away from solutions looking for problems. So this is kind of a lot part of the smart cities mantra circa 2016, 2017. Very simplistic silver bullet solutions that would solve all our problems. You know, the Amazon of transportation, you know, this one thing. I'm just coining these buzzwords. And, you know, cities and the built environment and our public spaces are living, breathing organisms. And they're very complex, and they require a lot of nuance, a lot of gray area to basically unpack a lot of the problems that we're trying to solve at the ground level. So basically, we need to work backwards. We need to define our problems we're solving first. We need to define the use cases and then fit the technology, whether it's AI, whether it's other forms of innovation, to solve those problems. So it's not build it and they will come. This is not Field of Dreams stuff. So I love the movie with Kevin Costner, Field of Dreams, but that does not apply here. It's not build it and they will come. That doesn't work. That doesn't work in urbanism and mobility. We have to be more nuanced, and we have to think about the problem and work backwards and fit the technology to resolve those problems. And I think that's one of the positive takeaways of, again, this post-COVID theme, this this messaging that I've been promoting, which is about being smarter about the technology and innovations that we've developed, our investments from venture capital, et cetera, from Silicon Valley, from Berlin and Amsterdam, and be much more critical about pitch decks that are coming from founders that are VCs and LPs are financing. But not only that, but we need to basically resolve a lot of these urban challenges that we're trying to address, whether it's congestion, whether it's CO2 emissions reduction, whether it's kind of reconfiguring our public space and managing parking, all these issues. We have the technology already developed, and we need to be smarter about deploying our capital, our assets, as well as our innovations to solve the problems, and not the solutions looking for problems.
I love that phrase, solutions looking for problems. I feel like you might be breaking a lot of venture capitalists' hearts right now. But
yeah, well, that was 2016. That was all the pitch coming from Silicon Valley, 2016, 2017, were these huge silver bullet solutions, and they were just overly simplistic. And I think the pandemic has forced us to think harder. It's forced mayors, cities, citizens, venture capitalists, as well as other stakeholders to scrutinize and question these solutions and cut through the hype and really get to what matters.
Let's come back to this post-COVID city for a minute, because we have a question from Bettina Meyer. She says, post-COVID city, for me, it means a shift away from shared mobility towards personal mobility, like a bicycle or a scooter. Isn't it a step backwards? Is it a step backwards?
No, it's both. It's shared mobility and personal mobility. Let's unpack this. So post-COVID city is kind of a broad umbrella for shared mobility and active mobility. Active mobility could be personal mobility. So if we want to be very specific about it, but personal mobility that's active is still on the decarbonization spectrum, much greener than personal mobility in an automobile. So, you know, you get a many brownie points. You get a lot of credit for that. So if you replace a car journey with a cycle or scooter journey, you're well on your way to decarbonization. Now, in terms of fitting that in the mobility mix and let's say synthesizing personal active mobility with shared mobility, now that's the sweet spot. And that's where last mile, first mile comes in, and connecting these services through mobility hubs and viewing this as an entire, let's say, ecosystem or a toolbox where you have a range of tools, which every sump has. Every sump has a toolbox approach to investing X million euros for 10, 15 mobility hubs around metropolitan Milan. So these mobility hubs are going to be served as these magnets, these catalysts to bring active mobility users to start using public transport through wayfinding and through a series of physical and digital investments. Digital investments, what I mean by that is like mass mobility as a service. So booking your app, you know, trying to combine your multimodal journey or just wayfinding or, you know, journey planning, but also with kind of physical infrastructure investments. Like I said, mobility hubs, better signage, and better kind of digital information to help creatively nudge, you know, users into more sustainable modes. So it's all about behavioral change. So we could think of individual mobility as not shared. And if that's also combined with shared transport, you know, public transport, bus, rail, metro, you know, we're on our way. And that's what every city in Europe, I guarantee you, every city in Europe has a policy goal to achieve that. So these are not mutually exclusive. It's not binary. And it's all a cumulative network effect. And that's what we're all as urbanists here in Europe trying to achieve. And I believe we have a huge net positive game. If you look at a range of cities throughout Europe, you know, this is something I actually wrote about recently, and was as much media attention Paris has been getting with the Olympics, with the 15-minute city, with the work of Carlos Moreno and Mayor Anne Hidalgo, which is great. I credit all their work. They dominate about 99% of the media headlines. And really what I like people to start thinking about is, at least here in continental Europe, the hundreds of other cities that are doing just as well as Paris at a much more modest level with smaller budgets, the small to mid-sized cities, you know, the Bratislavas, the Warsaws, the Lisbons, the Milans, etc. And they're all doing the same thing that Paris is doing on a smaller scale, but with a much greater net positive impact in terms of their reconfiguring of their infrastructure to promote sustainable mobility. So we need to really start drawing experience, not just as Paris or Amsterdam or Copenhagen as models for sustainability, but all these cities in accumulation are doing it right. And this is just in the last two or three years since the pandemic. So we have so many different, let's say, success stories that it's really, it's an exhaustive list. And it's something I've, you know, written about and studied quite recently.
I'm glad you brought up cities, because I'd love to get your take on how cities can start to or continue to integrate key stakeholders. So what, citizens, infrastructure, regulatory bodies, 5G networks, OEMs, to create this seamless ecosystem that we're all striving towards. Can you give us some successful models or strategies for creating this kind of alignment?
Well, you know, that's always a challenge in terms of, you know, you have vested interests and you have the status quo, of course. You have different groups that, to use the American term, NIMBY, not in my backyard, that want to preserve the status quo. Maybe on the face, they might be green and sustainable, but they advocate for the status quo, a lack of change. So it's about breaking down these silos and these barriers to get to YIMBY, yes, in my backyard. So something that we want to build and collaborate together. And these terms are really much more in kind of the urban planning world, but it applies to European mobility too, because yes, in my backyard applies for yes, for sustainable mobility and a transformation of the options so that we move around a city in a way that is more flexible and adhering to a range of stakeholders. I would say if we think about this in a sense, we need to kind of reframe a lot of the messaging and a lot of the, let's say, benefits and value add around the public policy goals so that it's a win-win. So, you know, if we look at, I'll just give you a quick example from the economic development perspective here, some great work happening in the UK, but even here in mainland Europe, you know, I'll use the British term, but in the US we call it Main Street or, you know, downtown, but I will use the word High Street in the UK. It's a term I'm still becoming familiar with, but in the High Street, you know, basically trying to regenerate city centers around low emission zones and trying to basically reactivate retail storefronts through increased retail activity, footfall, and pedestrian cycling activity as a benefit for small business owners. So by making this connection, this business case around economic development is a catalyst for regeneration of high streets, downtowns, et cetera, through active mobility and transport, the business case, the economic case can make really clear sense. And if you just look at the dollars and cents behind it or the euros and cents behind it, it makes a lot of sense. And that reduces the resistance for, let's say, more of the reactionary stakeholders, the folks that were more NIMBY will get to YIMBY because they will see that it just makes more business sense.
Yeah,
so that's just one example of many. I didn't talk about 5G or OEM. I apologize. It's probably a really broad topic, but it's just an example of bringing parties to the table in a win-win fashion so that there's a benefit for them because it always has to be a monetary value.
Yeah.
You know, what's in it for them? Well, the money's in it for them by the cost savings or increased, receipts.
That makes a lot of sense. At the end of the day, so many of these decisions do come down to the cold, hard cash.
Yeah.
Scott, I'm curious, do you see a role for AI in the acceleration, adoption, scaling of these technologies?
I do. AI, especially in kind of the urban planning and design realm, is helping cities as well as urban developers and mobility specialists visualize our public spaces through, let's say, new tools that can be visioning exercises of trying to understand what are the possibilities of reconfiguring in our public spaces. I think a lot of these AI visualization tools, just I'm giving one example of many. I'm not talking about LLMs or chatbots or any of that stuff, but just on the urban planning side, as it focuses on mobility, it's really interesting as a use case because it gives citizens, politicians, and their stakeholders a view of how their spaces could transform and improve over time using a lot of these different kind of photosynthesized types of, you know, exercises through design workshops, et cetera. I've seen a lot of the tools out there. There's a lot of interesting startups that are doing that. I'm personally a member of a think tank, Urban AI, based in Paris, and I work with several different startups and others that are working kind of in this AI visualization space. So there's a lot of great innovation and technology around this, which is making the case for better urban design in the post-COVID city.
I want to give you just a quick rapid fire response round. And I'm curious, Scott, if there was one thing as we come to the end of our discussion today that you could wave a magic wand and immediately change to improve how cities around the globe look and feel like, what would it be and why?
Zoning. American zoning has been the bane of our existence in the US, Canada, most of the English-speaking world. And unfortunately, it's kind of been introduced here in Europe to a minor extent over the last 70, 80, 90 years, and it's destroyed cities. So single purpose, single family zoning has utterly destroyed a range of cities across three or four continents and probably 10 to 15 countries. And if there's a magic wand, we call it Euclidean zoning. If we could get rid of single purpose, single use zoning, we would have much more, let's say, inclusive, multi-purpose cities that existed before the First World War, not the Second World War. A lot of the damage that was done to our cities happened in the interwar period in the 1920s. So let's not forget that. It's been a century of poor urban planning. And this was all a conscious human policy decision that needs to be undone. So what we need to do now as urbanists and mobility specialists is take back control of our cities. And to use the English term, we need to ameliorate. We need to fix these bad decisions that we made over 100 years and improve our spaces for the next 100 years. So I would get rid of this single purpose zoning that in my magic wand.
A very simple answer, not so simply executed perhaps, but short and to the point. Scott Shepherd, it's been such a pleasure having you today as part of the IAA Mobility Visionary Club. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. If you like what you heard, I can only encourage you to check out Scott's own podcast, CEO of #CitiesFirstAdvisors, Scott Shepherd. It was our pleasure. I will see you again next month for a new episode of the IAA Mobility Visionary Club. Have a great month.